Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
See if this is... this on? Okay, good. Welcome to the first meeting of the Sunstone Symposium in tonight's plenary session. I would like to announce before we begin that there are still some tickets left for the dialogue banquet tomorrow evening. They are $12, and there is more information in your program as to location and time and so on. This evening's program has been discussed and put together over a number of months, and we are quite delighted with the speakers that we have. And I would like to introduce them to you, and also the topic of changing family roles. About 16 years ago, after the birth of my first child, I remember one Sunday standing out in the foyer after church talking with my bishop about my working part-time. I was teaching a university course, or two university night courses, I should say. And he was talking about, you know, appropriateness, not appropriateness with having small children. And there were three other families, couples talking. And he was very supportive, and I appreciated that. But we did get into the issue of women working and childcare and who takes care of children and the whole gamut of changing family roles. And he said at one point in the discussion, I believe that women's issues and family roles will be a much bigger issue for the church in the long run than the black issue ever was. And I think in the years since then that gradually has become more and more true as his prophecy is being fulfilled. And in fact, this year, it is one of the issues of the year, which is why we chose this topic. In my experience, one of the reasons why it is such an important issue for all of us is that it really has the capacity, more than almost any other issue, to reach us at the core of our beings, because how we play our roles out in our families, with each other as marriage partners, or as parents, or as sisters and brothers and children to our own parents, we really touch the core of meaning of life and our own description and feeling about ourselves. And interestingly enough, while that is happening to all of us at the same time, and we may be thinking about it intellectually, we may be arguing it out, or we may be playing it out in some way, we are also playing it, all of these issues, out in the tragic, comic, and awfully mundane context of dirty diapers and unpaid bills and hugs and fights, and it's happening around us all the time that we're thinking about it. Virginia Satir, who is a famous national figure in the field of family therapy, probably best suggests why this issue of family roles and changing family roles really affects us, even at times when we are not players. She suggests an image in families of us being in a family group where we're all tied about the waist with a rope. And we are tied with a rope, whether thick or thin, or loose or slack or tight, to other members in our family. And every other member of the family has a rope around their waist, and it's tied in turn to us and other people in the family. And that we play that role out from day to day, and that all what has to happen to have an effect on us is that another family member can move a bit, change their position, pull a bit tighter, let go or loosen, and we feel it, and we react, and we are moved or changed in our position also, even though we may not at that point be an active actor, maybe only a passive observer. And if you think about that visual metaphor, it is true that any time something happens, not only in our families, and we hear news from home, so to speak, whether it's from home or not, we move. We are moved by it, and we are changed, and our meaning about life and about ourselves sometimes changes. And that when we hear news of other families and our friends' families, the same thing happens, because in that figurative sense, we all have ropes around our waists. And in the church setting, I believe that analogy also holds, that as a tight, closed culture that Mormon culture has been for so many years, that we have developed family-like connections and interactions with each other on a very large scale, so that when we hear news over the pulpit, or when we other member of the church family shifts position in our ward regarding how they are working or taking care of children, or whether they are deciding for themselves to rearrange how they are doing the power in their marriage, we are moved a bit as the rope around our waist tightens, moves, and then we get a new perspective on life. And even as we hear it through the larger church channels, through the church news and from general authorities talks, and even in a societal way through media and television and friends who tell us all what is happening in families, we continue to be moved and our position continues to be changed. We have chosen four people who have vast years-long experience in all of this, both personal and professional. I would like to introduce you in order of appearance, meaning as they are listed on the program, and as they ask me to introduce them. L. Jackson Newell is the Dean of Liberal Education at the University of Utah. He is co-editor of Dialogue currently, a Journal of Mormon Thought, and he is married to Linda Newell, and they are the parents of four children. Tim Heaton is associate professor of sociology at Brigham Young University. He is married to Tammy Heaton, and they are the parents of four children. Catherine Della Piana is a member of the board of directors Mothers at Home. She also works at the Rape Crisis Center, where she is counselor and coordinator of Evoca Ed program for victims of sexual abuse. She is married to Vern Della Piana, and they are the parents of three daughters. And our last panelist is Cheryl May, who is adjunct assistant professor of political science at the University of Utah, and she is recently completing a two-year study of vocational education in Utah for the U.S. Department of Education. She is married to Dean May, and they are the parents of three children. Before we hear from our panelists in order and then have a discussion afterwards, we'll first be treated to a musical number. The two musicians are Cindy Henderson on the flute and Mark Pierce on the piano. They will be playing Cantilena from the Poulenc, a sonata for the piano and flute. Thank you.
Thank you for that lovely music. I've had a wonderful time preparing for these remarks and our discussion tonight. A topic as close to home, as Mary Beth has already said, and to all of us, and one in that precipitates good discussion with almost anyone you ask. How do you feel family roles and roles in the household and relationships between men and women in the family and in the workplace are changing and have changed? So I've discussed this not only with Linda at some length, it even precipitated a hot discussion at one point about things I might say here and things I might not. Discussed it with our children, all four of them ranging in age from 12 to 21. Discussed it with people with whom I work and just good friends, saying, how do you feel things are different today than they were when you were younger? How do you feel expectations of you may have changed or are changing and the like? And I have several observations that I'd like to pass along as a result of this as a way of starting our panel tonight. The first is that I think we're perhaps in need of getting some perspective on the changes that are taking place in sex roles and in family relationships as we're talking about tonight. I think it rates, as almost any sociologist or historian would tell us, as one of the great social changes in all history. We're right smack in the midst of it. It's an upheaval. There is no question about it in the traditions of relationships between men and women and the expectations that we have of each other and in our own lives and for ourselves. And it ranks up there and I think is quite closely related to other major changes that will characterize our century as historians and others look back in centuries ahead. Revolutions in medicine, obviously, with great impact on women, particularly changes in birth control, which have provided women very greatly changed control over their lives, and of course affecting both men and women very greatly. Changes in medicine have brought an enormous change in life expectancy. War, obviously, has had a huge impact on our lives in the 20th century, and the threat of war, and particularly the Second World War, had an enormous liberating effect on women, as 16 million American men were in uniform. Primarily 16 million men and 16 million jobs almost were taken by women at home. And when the war was over and the men came home, the women were not all content to go back after they had been running businesses and being for women in industry and the like. So I think at the outset it's necessary for us to reflect that this is not only something that's affecting you and me, or this isn't a local Mormon problem, but we're talking about one of the major upheavals of society in all history, and certainly one of the most important changes to transpire in the century in which we're living. Life has forever changed. I tell my students in one of the courses that I teach that the life expectancy of a woman in 1900 was 47 years, and the number of children that the typical woman would have was about 8. If you plot out a woman's life and have 8 children and start around the age of 18 or 20, it's very clear that the entirety of a typical woman's life at the turn of the century, my grandmother's age, was consumed by rearing children. In all likelihood, she passed away before the last child was even raised. And in fact, was the case with both of my grandmothers. Today, on the other hand, life expectancy of women is now pressing 80, and the typical birth rate in the United States is 2 children per woman. In Utah, it's something like 4, and in both cases, it's dropping. Certainly, it's dropping in Utah. It's now down to about 3.5 and may go lower. Tim Heaton will have more information about this for us indeed. What this means in simplest terms is that even a woman who chooses to have a traditional child-rearing role in the early part of her life is going to face more than half of her productive adult years with an empty nest, which means, again, expectations and opportunities are forever changed. I was in a group of friends recently, and somebody said, why don't we just all, for the fun of it, close our eyes for a minute and try to think of the ideal couple, the couple that we know that has the most ideal relationship, and then perhaps we could say something about what would characterize that couple and how it might compare, in fact, with the relationships that we have with our spouses. I thought for some time, and I thought longer, and finally I said, I can't think of a couple that I think has an ideal relationship today. Not one. Linda and I have a fine relationship, but it's certainly not ideal. I don't know anybody I'd trade. That's a very powerful comment. I gave it some additional thought, and then I can think of one that I think pretty nearly meets that criterion of what would look like a couple after many years of marriage who just are at great peace with each other and still enjoy great romance. It's an immigrant couple in our ward. They're both 82 years of age. That's a very powerful message because both of them came to the United States in the wake of World War II, having lived the first half of their life in Germany and the second half of their life here. For them, what was expected of each other and what they expected of themselves was prescribed by the culture from which they came from the very earliest days. And most of the aspects of their roles were not negotiable. Otto and Rosa both know what they're supposed to do in their relationship. In fact, for virtually all of us today, everything is negotiable, or at least almost everything is negotiable when we compare Linda's and my relationship, for example, with Rosa and Otto. We have to decide what now in our time is the responsibility of the man in the home and what is the responsibility of the woman. And we have to decide every year or two, as changes come and the opportunities that both Linda and I enjoy, who's going to do a little more of this and who's going to do a little bit more of that. Linda said to me the other night, for example, as I turn to full-time writing during this coming year, I wonder if you could assume responsibility for doing the grocery shopping this coming year. Interesting. That sparked an interesting debate as well, perhaps even more than interesting. What? I'm busy. How can I assume that responsibility as well? But you see, the thing that brings us up short in terms of what are sources of conflict for us today and what may not have been for our parents' or grandparents' generation is the fact that that question would never have been raised in Otto and Rosa's home. Rosa knew it was her responsibility to buy the groceries. Today, it's a good thing we don't have those roles so tightly defined, but we have to recognize with the fact that we are all more free to decide what responsibilities we'll assume in relationships, that means all those decisions have to be made. And every decision, obviously, is a potential source of some kind of conflict or at least negotiation. So I don't believe there are ideal relationships that exist today among couples that I know. Maybe you know some that are. If so, I'd be pleased to hear about them, perhaps in the discussion period. The church, obviously, is caught in this enormous social change in a number of ways. If we just bring ourselves up for short for a moment and realize that every single decision that is made that pertains to the church in general is made solely and completely by men, it gives us an idea of the degree to which the church may have a stake in what we might say is the traditional rather than the emerging culture, as we have two cultures which are overlapping with each other in our lifetimes, in our era. Also, since people who were my age in their late 40s grew up in homes where expectations were much more clearly established, more like Rosa and Otto than like Linda's and my relationship, in the 24 years that we've been married, we've naturally transformed our expectations of each other from what started out at the time of our wedding as being very much stereotyped like our parents enjoyed, now to being very much more like what we would consider to be a contemporary relationship between men and women, perhaps earlier in a life stage or earlier in their marriage. But it seems perhaps because of the age of the church leaders, all of whom were raised in the traditional culture rather than the emerging one, and because of the stake that the church has in male leadership throughout, it's clear that the church has staked its claim on trying to preserve as much of the traditional culture as possible rather than embracing the new and finding ways in which the new can perhaps incorporate many of the values that were rich and rewarding and beautiful in the old, while also recognizing things about our lives and our culture which are forever changed, that I mentioned just a little bit ago. One of the scholarly interests that I have had for many years is the American Revolution. And one of the things that strikes us about that era was what they themselves called a sense of history. If you read Jefferson, if you read Madison, if you read any of the founding fathers, they had a sense that they were forging new relationships among men and women, new relationships between men and women and the society in which they lived. Not new relationships between men and women of the type that we're talking about tonight, but new relationships among people and new relationships between individuals and institutions, particularly our governments. And that's one of the reasons they wrote with such passion about what they did, and they maintained a very high degree of optimism about what they were doing. They believed they were going to succeed because they felt that they were the wave of a whole new era, that they were pioneers, that they were creating something which would lastingly improve and change the quality of life for human beings. And it's clear also, if we look at our church history, that there was very much the same sense with the early church pioneers in the Midwest and with the early church pioneers here in Salt Lake Valley and in the West. A sense that something of historic magnitude and importance was transpiring, and they were a part of it. The strange thing, and the thing that makes me think so often, is that we are a part of a much more subtle but equally profound revolution in our era, and very seldom do we, it seems to me, feel a sense of history, or is there among us a sense of promise that though there are difficulties and there are pushes and pulls and we're responding in difficult ways to advice that comes to us from church leaders and from our peers and from ourselves and from our spouses, too often we view these things as great difficulties rather than looking at them, in fact, as difficulties that are a part of an incredibly important change which is taking place. Rollo May, in the introduction to his book, The Courage to Create, said, "We are living in a time when one age is dying and another is not yet born." And he created, he used the term creativity as the expression of what he felt was necessary to bring new order out of chaos when, in fact, one culture is beginning to disintegrate and another one is just taking shape. And he laments the fact that we too often believe that creativity is expressed primarily in the arts or in music. And he said, in any way that we are involved in bringing new form out of chaos, in forging new institutions, new relationships, that is an act of creativity, and that, in fact, is the essence of what it is to be a human being. So I guess my final thought in these introductory remarks is simply that I think we would do well ourselves to develop a sense of history about the changes in which we are involved, and to view these as opportunities for us to be creative about the ways in which we preserve and build upon the best of the past, at the same time realizing that the past is gone forever, and that it is necessary for us to build a new future and what might be even become a better future if we do it well. Many times, Linda and I, after negotiating and renegotiating things in our relationship, have found some solace in the fact that we could step back, laugh a little bit, and say, we are, after all, pioneers in a new way of trying to do this. May we all develop a sense of that pioneering spirit, or a sense that we are, in fact, on the edge of a new age, and that sense of history which may cause us not only to respond more positively to the challenges we have, but perhaps more creatively in the way in which we record the struggles. Our children and grandchildren may sometime find them, if not amusing, perhaps instructive. Thanks.
I hope this wasn't supposed to be a debate. Contrary to the tradition of our two universities, I find myself agreeing with what Jack has said. I would simply like to elaborate in some more specific terms about the types of changes that I see occurring in families. In the 1970s, dramatic changes in family patterns led some social observers to predict the demise of the family as a major social institution. It appears, however, that declining family size, delayed marriage, rising cohabitation, and higher divorce do not sound taps for families, but do mark important changes in how people live out their family careers. Although Mormons have a very unique theology of the family and exhibit distinctive family behavior, patterns of Mormon family life have also changed dramatically and will, I predict, continue to change in the future. Tonight, I would like to briefly mention five major areas of change and discuss some of their implications. First, more women are leaving the home for gainful employment. Mormon women work at about the same rate as women nationally. Over 50% are in the labor force. Compared with women in the nation, married Mormons are more likely to stay home when they have preschool children, or are more likely to work part-time if they have children at home. Once the children leave home, if there are no children at home, or if Mormon women are single, they are more likely to work than their national counterparts. Those who work get about the same types of jobs as non-LBS women, and employed women make a substantial contribution to the household economy, often bringing the family out of poverty. I suspect that much of the money they earn goes to children, for things like education, missions, and activities which help the children achieve awards such as the Ezra Taft Benson Scholarship at BYU. I know because I've been on the committee. In other words, employment becomes a means of improving, not detracting from family life. Female economic employment is nothing new. In most types of societies, women have made a substantial contribution to production of food, clothing, and craft goods. It was not until the Industrial Revolution separated economic production from the home that women's work became an issue. It wasn't until then that female employment left no one at home to care for children. The religious issue here is child care, not female employment. The Bible and Book of Mormon have little to say about women's economic production, even though women were undoubtedly working in those societies. The church should be very concerned about the quality of child care and the quality of socialization of children. But I fear that making a religious issue out of women's economic contributions is not soundly based in LDS theology and will detract from the well-being of many families. Second trend. Thank you. Family size will continue to decline, but will remain well above the national average, at least in the immediate future. I'm amazed by the wide variation in fertility among various groups that can all be referred to as pronatal. Hutterites probably have the record, averaging around 12 children. Late 19th century Mormons were somewhat lower, with 11 children. Current general authorities average 6 children, about half the typical Hutterite family. Temple married couples are probably now averaging about 4 children. And demographer that I am, I calculated that the panel averages 3.5 children. If maximizing biological reproduction were the major goal, we would not send 19-year-old men on missions, and we would encourage women to marry before their 14th birthday. By not doing so, we are implicitly admitting that social conditions must be considered in planning our family careers. My point is simply that we can place a high value on raising children without being too specific about how many children are needed to qualify as a respectable family. Third, Mormon household composition has become and will remain very diverse. Only 1 in 5 Mormon households fits the ideal you see on the front of the ensign, with a husband, wife, married in the temple, and children still at home. Only half of the women now can expect to marry and remain married to the same person until they're 60 years old. Divorce, single status, and living alone are real prospects for a substantial share of the Mormon population. Apparently, we have not learned how to deal with this diversity. Interfaith marriages do not fare well in the LDS Church, and the institutional participation of singles is not as high as their personal devotion. As Marie Cornwall has noted in the latest issue of Sunstone, the singles problem is also a marriage problem. Married people are often insensitive to the needs and feelings of singles. I sense a real need for church programs and individual sensitivity which provide fellowship and support for people in very diverse family situations. Otherwise, a narrow definition of acceptable family structure will make strangers and foreigners of a large fraction of our people. Fourth trend. I anticipate that increasing pressure will be on men to make more contributions in the home. This should be a positive influence on family life. One of the best predictors of Mormon women's marital satisfaction is the husband's sharing of child care. In fact, shared child rearing has a greater impact on marital satisfaction than various aspects of religious involvement. It is heartening to note that temple marriage indirectly promotes shared child rearing, but other aspects of religious involvement have a less direct benefit in the home in terms of husbands helping with child care. Once again, it seems that we are not doing enough as a religion to encourage behavior that will improve the quality of family life. Men should not be content to define their role as the 3 P's of patriarchy. In case you're wondering, the 3 P's of patriarchy are preside, provide, and procreate. Fifth, and finally, I see increasing inconsistency between the improving status of women in society and the subordinate role sometimes ascribed to Mormon women in their families and in their church. There is a large group of Mormon women who are highly educated, very capable, and deeply committed to their religion. The church could not survive in its present form without the great contribution of these faithful women. Yet some feel a growing sense of dissatisfaction with second-class status. Some have formed organizations and activities to provide fellowship and social support they cannot find in the established programs of the church. I fear that status inconsistency will be personally very stressful to those who feel it and to their families, and that the benefit of the church in their lives will decline as a result. In sum, the family is undergoing significant change. Traditional gender roles and church programs need to be carefully examined in light of these changes. In the past, we as a church have been able to adjust and respond to dramatic changes in family while maintaining our unique family theology and commitment. I hope that we will be able to do so in the future. Thank you.
I was asked to speak to you tonight partially because of my involvement in an organization called Mothers at Home, a support and education organization for mothers. It began 2 years ago in Virginia, and from the beginning, the press took an interest in an organization that was talking about home issues at a time when a lot of women were entering the workforce. The first story was written by an AP reporter named Ann Blackman. Now an editor at Time magazine, she wrote that the response to the story that she wrote was overwhelming. She quotes, and I quote her, she said, "Response to this story exceeded that of any story I have ever written, and I've been writing about controversial social issues for the last 13 years. It obviously struck a nerve," unquote. Letters and calls flooded in from across the country, and we heard from thousands of women within 2 weeks. The women that wrote to us in these unsolicited letters expressed their feelings about the changing roles. These women were from urban areas. They were from rural areas. They described themselves as politically conservative, politically liberal, and they were mothers who were at home at the current time, and they were mothers who were working. I relate some of what we heard from these women nationally because I think there are parallels for the Mormon women and parallels to what we experience today. First, these women expressed to us that the stereotypes of the typical mother at home and the typical working mother are not accurate. They're in fact creations of the media and have little to do with the reality of our daily lives. One of the consequences of those stereotypes tends to be the polarization of women. Sheila Luftig from Hartborough, Pennsylvania wrote, quote, "It's not surprising that many people maintain misconceptions. It's partially perpetuated by the advertising industry, which makes it difficult to turn on the television and avoid being trapped in a world of stereotypes. Women are too often presented in two extremes. Superwomen who hold down the corporation rush home to a spotless house and fix a gourmet meal while still looking sexy for their husband. And women who panic at the thought of someone removing their fabric softener from the market. I believe women can and should be what they desire. We must continue to fight to achieve that constitutionally guaranteed right, but we must fight the system, not each other. We must not allow ourselves to be torn apart by the stereotypes that we are fed," unquote. But those subtle and not so subtle messages that we receive about our choices affect how we feel about what we're doing and make the parenting, regardless of our work choices, a much more difficult job. A divorced mother of two wrote about her experience of having to enter the workforce, put her children in daycare, and change her way of life. She wrote that at a time when she needed praise for surmounting problems, she often got criticism for, quote, abandoning her children. She writes, There's a big thing about facing what is demanded and finding one's way through it and trying to feel okay about it. I get angry and hurt when I read articles that reinforce a belief about a family that I have but cannot act upon, and paint a picture of life that I cannot have with my boys. The second thing that we learned from these women who wrote us is that most women who choose to have children feel that those children are a priority in their life, and they work very hard at keeping it that way, regardless of whether they're at home or at work. Kathy Miller Rindock, a working mother from Allentown, Pennsylvania, wrote, "I've always considered myself a feminist. Consequently, I was totally unprepared for the depth and strength of emotion that I would feel for Cassie. I was financially unprepared to be able to spend some time at home with her. I'm hurt and I'm angry." Diane Durham, Houston, Texas, said, "I am an attorney who's become deliberated by my 14-month-old daughter. Gloria Steinem can no longer be my complete role model. As I was a pathbreaker 10 years ago in the professional world, I find myself again a pathbreaker as I choose to shelve temporarily my professional life to commit to raising a family. My priorities have shifted. The priority shift has not been without personal conflict, but it has been with conviction." I think the third thing that I wanted to mention that... Sure. Yeah. I thought maybe she was giving me that. If she goes like this, she wrote me a little note that if we went too long, she was going to signal us. So let me know if she's doing it. We found that women, regardless of their choices, experienced a tremendous amount of conflict about those choices. And as they tried to balance their own personal development and their family needs. From Madison, Wisconsin, a woman wrote about her experience. She took a year's maternity leave after the birth of her baby and then returned to work, but she continued to struggle with her decision about whether or not to be at home. "Even though I have a master's degree in counseling and have worked 6 years in the field, I find it impossible to counsel myself. I enjoyed being at home, but it's difficult to replace my self-concept to exclude work outside the home where so many people put the value." Loretta Brooks from Washington said she'd been home 10 years, had no desire to work outside the home. "Is it wrong to love creating a home?" As Mormon women, we're not exempt from making those decisions, as has been mentioned previously. And as Mormon women, we too experience those societal stereotypes. But they're intensified by the attachment of a moral and religious significance. Our choices about work and family are often become measuring sticks of obedience and religious commitment. And we experience the feelings of conflict. Mormon women of my generation, and I think many of them that I've talked to feel this way, we straddled two eras. We were reared with one philosophy and taught another. Many of us had mothers who stayed at home and a church that insisted that that was the only place to be. We learned about the importance of motherhood. But we also grew up with the women's movement, Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan, and some of those messages spoke to us, and they made sense. They seemed congruent with our belief about our own divine potential and personal progress. So we feared giving up life that we enjoyed growing up and wanted the best of it for our children. And we feared giving up the potential for progress in the workplace or our own personal development. The cognitive dissonance that resulted from these two seemingly opposing philosophies had to be resolved. And I think, as I've observed Mormon women, I've observed two different ways that they tend to resolve those. One is to eliminate or to reject one of those two philosophies completely. And I think, to a certain extent, some women do that. I think the second is to find a way to meet the needs of a family without ignoring our own. In the second choice, we begin to seek options that allow us to nurture our families and still accomplish other personal goals. Mormon women, in doing that, are refusing to exchange one socially imposed role for another. And I think that as we begin to do that, we start to redefine what it means to be at home and what working means. Women, and I think Timothy's statistics supported this. Women move in and out of the workforce as family patterns change. Some work part-time, others work from their homes, and others stay at home while children are young and work outside the home later. Still others work in the nonprofit world as volunteers or seeking an education or pursuing a variety of activities. And others seek full-time but flexible working hours. We're currently considering these issues, however, from, I believe, solely from a work perspective. And I suggest to you that as we do that, we obscure another message. And one example of that is the March 1986 Newsweek article about a year ago. I don't know how many of you read it, but the emphasis on work certainly colors the interpretation of the article. In the text of the article, you read, quote, "It's not that women don't want to work. They do. In fact, even mothers at home say they would prefer to work. According to a poll done by the Gallup organization, 71% of the mothers at home surveyed said they would like to work. A total of 75% of working mothers also said they would work even if they didn't need the money," unquote. A few pages later, the detailed results of that poll are presented in a chart form. And Newsweek's 71% of the at-home mothers who say they would prefer to work was calculated by adding together the responses of women who said they would like to work full-time, flex-time, part-time, and from home. In fact, only 9% of the non-working mothers interviewed said they would like to work full-time hours. There's indicated an interest in being at home at least part of the regular working day, a figure which gives a completely different impression. While the text states that 75% of working mothers would keep their jobs even if they didn't need the money, the chart shows that only 13% wanted to work full-time. In other words, 87% of the poll's working mothers would prefer to be at home at least part of the normal working day. By far, the most preferred category was part-time work, and more working mothers wanted to quit completely than wanted to work full-time. By choosing to emphasize mothers wanting to work, the poll overlooked the Gallup results that showed the strong desires of mothers to spend more time at home. Mothers are indeed participating in the workforce in record numbers. There are more mothers than ever, as mentioned by both of these two speakers, there are more mothers than ever solely responsible for the economic well-being of their families or jointly responsible where a single income won't make ends meet. There are also more women with careers they want to pursue and educational backgrounds that they want to utilize. But there's another message that I think is mistakenly denied, and it is that mothers continue to spend as much time as possible with their children. As we chart our own courses as women, we discover that the accepted definition of staying at home is inaccurate. There is some fulfillment in nurturing, and time with family is a central part of our lives. Secondly, I think we discover that the traditional definition of work, 8 to 5, 5 days a week, longer if you're superwoman or superman, is often confining and limiting. With our strong commitment to family, and I believe it's one that we share with people across the United States, I think that Mormon men and Mormon women ought to be at the forefront of some of the changes that need to be made to accommodate these new roles. First, the recognition, not just an acknowledgement, but the recognition of the importance of the role of parents. And second, the establishment of work policies and patterns that we often talked about in the 60s, but are not really readily available, at least in the business world, for most people. Those include flex time, part-time with benefits, job sharing, working from home, and sick and maternity leave for both parents. As we make these discoveries and changes, we need to seek, encourage, and expect concurrent changes in the workplace, in our homes, in our church, and in the roles of men. Thank you.
Good evening. Is that about right? I have found this assignment not to be an easy one for the last 6 weeks since it was given to me. I have found myself preoccupied when I was in front of the word processor and I was supposed to be working on these federal reports. We've just been on a family vacation, and four different times I took a wrong freeway exit because I was thinking about this darn thing. I would much rather be talking to you about something that I feel I have a little special expertise in. I'm gangbusters on the Strategic Defense Initiative. I could talk to you for more of you, longer than most of you would wish knowledgeably about vocational education in Utah. I could even recommend within three square blocks good restaurants in any of four price ranges. But instead, I have been asked to talk to you as one of you, at least as a parent among many of you here tonight who have shared the experience of being a Mormon parent. And in doing so, since I feel no great expertise whatsoever, I'm forced to be personal and to relate personal experiences and feelings. Perhaps I can begin with a discussion that I had about two or three weeks ago with a person with whom I work at BYU, worked with her for a number of years, who is a departmental secretary, wonderful, lovely, capable person. And I mentioned to her as I was filling out some forms, I'm going to be working part-time there next year too, that I was going to be talking about this subject. And her response surprised me, startled me a little bit. She said, oh, and at the time I was told what I was really supposed to be responding to was President Benson's encyclical on women. And what she said to me was, oh, truer words were never spoken. If only I had listened to those words earlier. If only I had taken that message of church leaders seriously. I went out to work because I was sort of doing the dirty work for everybody else in my family who were having fun going out to work. And even though I knew I shouldn't, I did it, and it ruined my life. My divorce happened because my husband didn't want me to go to work. My son turned to drugs because I went to work. And she said, now I know the true way because I've seen it from both sides. And there was no way that she would take me the slightest bit seriously when I said, could there perhaps be more than two sides? Communication is so difficult on this issue. I guess it cuts very deep and very close. And yet, we have to keep, I think, trying to communicate with one another, and it's in that spirit that I share a few remarks with you this evening. The latest official pronouncements from the president of the church on the status of women indicates that there is a single successful recipe. Single recipe for successful families in the church. And that is the traditional role. It was a very sweeping statement. I mean, two afternoons a week with a PTA were suspect, if you read that statement carefully, not to mention taking on any kind of a professional career. Few comments that from my personal experience that I'd like to make about the statement, and I'm going to talk about not only my experiences, but without earlier permission or attribution, I'm going to talk about a lot of my friends. Number one, this model, almost as it was presented by President Benson, does work for some people. This is a successful model. I know women for whom this works, women who can become, who are really satisfied and fulfilled totally with the sort of mission of making their home work. And boy, that's great. And I have, and there are pressures from the outside world that these women feel, and that there's some reason why they're defensive. You know, it seems like it's us professional women, mothers in the church, who should feel defensive, but boy, these gals feel defensive too, so there've got to be reasons for that. But, you know, even in, I think, accepting and legitimizing and celebrating the fact that this model is great for some women, that if you look at the way in which it was put in this special address, which has now been printed up and circulated, and the home teachers bring it around and everything. So it's obviously supposed to be the standard line on the subject. That some of the quotes that are used, to me, show this sort of outside-looking-in view of how women must feel. Like there was a quote from President Kimball about the idea that women should get out of the laundry and out of the cafe and away from the typewriter and all these things that were keeping them from home, and that they should gain their fulfillment, and I'm quoting just about exactly here, from washing dishes, making beds, and cooking for their family. And you know, the women that I know, for whom this model really works, do not get their satisfaction from making their children's beds and doing things that anybody over the age of six should be able to do for themselves. You know, occasionally I do these things for my children, but I don't think it's what makes me a good mother. Instead, they get their satisfaction from really, in the cases where I've seen women who really pull this off, from making homemaking a career, and that works for them. And they might express themselves in home design, they might express themselves in their garden, they might express themselves in working in the PTA or in community activities, they might express themselves in teaching skills to the kids. There are all kinds of ways, but it's not in doing dishes and doing beds. And it's just great that there is a slice of womankind for whom this works. And the thing that seems such a shame is that there has to be an assumption that there's great diversity in talents and in energy and in interests among men, but none among women, that they can all achieve their goals in exactly the same way. And this is my biggest concern. The single recipe for successful families doesn't pass the reality test. Getting personal again, I think I'm a really successful person in terms of feeling good about myself. Certainly do better, but I was raised in a family where my mother worked full-time from the time I was eight, and it worked out just fine. And I worked full-time until we started having children, and we soon moved to Salt Lake within a year or so of the birth of our first child. And at that point, I decided I very much wanted to be home more with our child and the other children that I knew would come along. And so I switched to a part-time schedule. And from time that my children had been very small, 3-4 afternoons a week, they would be at a babysitter, usually with one of the sisters in the ward who were also bringing up kids and who were loving, wonderful people. And you know, our kids are fine. They're confident, they're secure, they're creative, they're achieving. They are perfect children, no. But they're doing okay. And it meant that for me, it was more important to spend part of the time with them than it was to rise in the academic world, to have a wonderful list of academic publications like my husband has behind his name, and to achieve some of the honors that I see some friends achieving and think, wow, I bet I could do that if I really tried. But it has been well worth it. I'm very happy with the balance generally that we have struck. In terms of what I tell a daughter, Jack talked about the great upheaval, the great revolution going on in male-female relationships in the modern world today. And I think that that's the case. But I think the revolution is moving more slowly than some of us might assume. I think most women in the foreseeable future are going to have the major responsibility for sort of keeping the family running. I can count on the fingers of one hand the families I know right now where that is not the case. Even though in many of these families the father's participating a lot more, I still think that it's going to be unrealistic for me to tell my daughter to expect to have a fully, equally negotiated marriage situation where she doesn't have to take any more of the responsibilities for the children and for the sort of family unit than her husband does. Because I think most women are going to continue to have more of these responsibilities than men are. I know that is true in my family. I think I have a fairly enlightened, liberated husband, but still, I'm the one that keeps that dynamism going. And so I would tell her that I think it would be in her interest to look for a job that had flexibility, where you don't lose everything if you have to duck out for a few years, if you want to have that time with your children, if you take it part-time. There are certain research fields and other fields where, my gosh, if you are out for 2 or 3 years, especially if you're doing some cutting-edge research or if you, let's say you wanted to be a an international concert violinist. I'm sure some of these people handle their families just fine, but it's tougher. And so I would suggest to her that she would try to work this flexibility into her career plans. However, I don't want to suggest that only women who have part-time careers, such as I have chosen to have while my children are these ages, now they're up to 9, 11, and 15, and I'm still hoping, like mad, that I can maintain this flexibility. I love it. But I also have dear friends who work full-time jobs and who are fantastic mothers. I have a friend who was the caliber of violinist that she was preparing for an international concert career, and then she met her now husband and decided that she'd really rather marry him, settle down, had 6 children, and the youngest is a toddler, and now for about the last year or so, she's been playing with the Utah Symphony. She could have had a more glorious career, but she chose a balance that worked for her. Have a friend who's a research pathologist and does brilliant work and goes all over the world. She goes probably 4 or 5 times a year to conferences to tell the other pathologists in the world how you do what she does. And she works full time. Her husband has a more flexible job, and she has the profession, her pathology profession, and her children, and virtually nothing else in the world. And she is a wonderful mother, and they are wonderful, achieving, terrific children. I could give countless more examples. I'm sure my time's about up. In terms of values, valuable insights from President Benson's address and the many other prophets that he quoted, I think that it's easy in today's world to become too selfish and materialistic and to forget that children are treasures, that children are the greatest treasure, that children must come first, and that will often require sacrifice on the part of mothers and on the part of fathers. It's never, I think, amiss to be reminded of that. But, you know, I think many of us are doing this pretty well. And I think it's also important, since we're not getting a lot of outside support from church authorities, if we're feeling good about what we're doing, to tell each other, to pat each other on the back and saying, this isn't easy, but it's worthwhile, and we're making it. And I've always been a very optimistic person, so I'd like to end with a very real hope that our children, or perhaps our grandchildren, will be able to hear this kind of supportive message from church authorities themselves. Thank you.
In our design for the evening, we wanted to have at least as much time for discussion as we did for deliberation from the mic. So we have an hour to an hour and 20 minutes to hear from you, to hear the questions, to hear your points of concern. We only have one mic from the floor, unfortunately. We had hoped to have more, but that's not the case. And so if you have a question, please come to the mic and speak it. If for some reason you can't make your way here, you'll need to have a sufficiently loud voice to do so, and then I will be glad to repeat the question. But our preference is that you come to the mic and make your statement. You may either address a panelist specifically, or a generalized question is also okay. Thank you.
Right on top.
I would like to ask both Jack and Tim if they share sentiments that I have heard my husband express, and we have one of these very flexible, negotiable marriages. But he has said that the feminist movement that has liberated women has also liberated him, in that he has much greater opportunity to be a father and a caring co-parent, and has greater ability to be at home and be a part of that nurturing home life. I know that my father-in-law, his father, who has been in that very traditional mother at home, father out providing, has expressed admiration for our relationship because of the fact that the husband has more opportunity to be that caring and nurturing parent. How do you feel about that? Have you found that to be the case in your own lives?
Yes, I've found it to be the case very much in my life, and one of the conversations I had with our 18-year-old daughter only about an hour and a half ago also documented this same point for the children. I said, what effect do you think the fact that Linda and I both have careers has had on your life, positively and negatively? And that our life is so stimulating, having both you and mother coming home every night with ideas about what's going on in the world. So I think the effect is not simply one of liberating the husband, and I don't know whether it's because the era we live in or my own natural interests, but fathering has been and continues to be probably the most rewarding thing in my life. Tim?
I certainly won't set myself up as an example of the ideal father, and I have had some rewarding experiences with my children, but there's the other side to that. The times I've spent at home with the children while my wife's been away, I've learned a lot about washing dishes and boredom and anger and other things that aren't quite so filling. So I think not only do you learn to appreciate the good things about child care, but also the bad things.
I found that happens particularly when Linda began taking research trips. The first one was one of the longer ones. She was gone, I think, 2 or 2.5 weeks, and Heather was still, in, if not in diapers, very young at the time. And I gained a greater appreciation in those 2 weeks for what Linda does and has done for a long time in her household than I ever would have gained had she not taken a long trip and I had full responsibility for the children myself at the time. It's become much easier in succeeding years where the older children pitch in and help me take care of the younger ones.
As I was listening, I was thinking that all of you have fairly flexible careers in academics or so on, and I was wondering for someone who's in their formative years, whether you would advise, would advise trying to plan for a career. For example, it's hard to do that, harder to do this in business and as I thought, law, but your comments on that.
I realize as a moderator I may not be a commenter, but I do have a lot of experience with this, and that is for about a period of 7 years I was a single parent and had three small children and was in a profession where I could not take summers off and could not work any less than 40 hours a week. And my experience of those years before my current arrangement, which is that I am flexible, is that I was delighted with the exhilaration of working. I was delighted with what I was learning, and I was exhausted. And I was in a lot of pain that I didn't have more time at home.
Well, I knew Chris would come to the mic. We worked together at the Rape Crisis Center. He told me he was going to come and ask a question. I'm glad it wasn't an embarrassing one. But so we've discussed this issue a little bit. And I have to say, from a personal perspective, it would be hard for me to select a career based solely on its flexibility, because you do spend so much time with that, but certainly, I mean, I would recommend that as a consideration as you make a decision, and if there are, and if you do have options, to choose one that would be more flexible.
Yeah, perhaps we even have to be flexible about flexibility. I think you, it's certainly preferable for both parents if they can they can come up with this kind of a career choice. But you also have to, the bottom line is knowing yourself and being true to yourself, and that you're going to create problems all along the line for yourself and your children if you don't know what you want and need, and what the world needs from you. And if that's to be, you know, a research biologist or working on superconductivity. Or right now, if you're working on superconductivity, you're going to have to be in the laboratory for 14 or 16 hours a day, because that's just, you know, you cannot leave for a week. And if that's what just drives you and consumes you, then it's going to be tough to let it go. You know, I think if you can get that flexibility, then you should. And sometimes you might have to just sacrifice a profession altogether if the family needs come first. I think that our religious commitment requires that. But there are some jobs that it's easier to withdraw from than others.
While we're on this topic of flexibility, it seems to me that there ought to be some room for traditional careers that have not been flexible, that there are ways for the working place to build in more flexibility for people. The Chinese model is a wonderful one, where they very often the woman is given 2 years to be at home, she has her job back, and there is a daycare center within the place that she works, and this is happening in some places in the United States too, where she can go on breaks and during her noon hour to be with her children if there is not a grandparent or an aunt or someone to take care of those at home. And how do we go about putting pressure or helping our society? And I think particularly in Utah that's difficult, because there is not a premium put on that. The premium is putting women back in the home, not in making their lives easier for those that have to be out of the home. Do you have some ideas about how that might be achieved in putting flexibility on the other side?
I was just going to say, I think in the early years when we, when the women's movement started, we spent a lot of time talking about that very thing, that if women moved into positions of power, that perhaps we would humanize the corporations and make those kinds of changes. The reality is that, especially in the business world, that hasn't happened, not to any great extent. And I think that here in Utah and as Mormons, as we achieve or arrive at those positions, that we take some responsibility for making those changes. I think that's one way to approach it.
All talk comes up, so when you get bored. No, it's a real dilemma, because there are two types of people now that need child care. Two earner couples that generally have very high incomes and can afford quite good quality child care if it were available, and single parents who cannot afford good child care. So one issue is how flexible is the job market, and the other is what kinds of child care are available for people who work. And for the single people who need child care, the job can be as flexible as you want, whatever hours, and they still have the problem of child care if they have children. So there's not a single solution. What's happened in the recent past, the way people have responded is by limiting the number of children they have. And we may at some point as a country reach a crisis in having enough children to become adults to keep society going. And it may take that kind of a crisis before we make any real effort to make the economy flexible enough for dual careers.
I have to bring up really strong feelings that I'm feeling as I sit here, because I think we're talking on an upper level of society all along the board here. I think we're talking about families that stay together. There's two parents. There's a multitude of choices. Everything is very flexible. Or another, the children are going to be cared for. And we have all these interesting ways. I suggest that this is maybe, at most, and I don't think it's anywhere near this, the upper third of society. I see children hurting. I see families breaking up. I see multitudes of children hurting. No child care. I see children out there with no parenting. The whole program of the problem of latchkey children is horrendous. The problem of even little tiny children that are just getting shuffled from someone who give a minimal basic keep alive care, and sometimes not even that. I see that almost two-thirds of our society right now. I've raised seven children and stayed with them. Not particularly because I didn't have any other interests, but because that was my situation. I did not have a helping husband. And I stayed with them, and I'm paying the price now, because now I'm going to start a career at 54. And I don't feel sorry about it. I mean, it was just the way it is. But when I look around, I could say, I'll take your children, and I would have 3,000 children at my home within 3 days, because there's just that many children out there hurting. I see President Benson's statement as defending the right of children to have any chance at all. I just don't think there's that many of us that are providing all these wonderful choices. Yes, there are some. Among my seven children, I have some of my children who have careers that are professional, and everything's fine. I have one son who is an oil rig worker. Now he has no income, and his four children are hurting. I went to see a family of a boy last night who committed suicide and left four little children. I don't know. I see it all around me. I have been so grateful in my life that I could go to the presiding priesthood in my life, those who cared, and find protection for my children. That if it wasn't there in my home, there were men that cared. That their priesthood responsibility told them that children matter. I'm grateful to President Benson. I am so grateful to him, and I'm grateful to all the leaders of the priesthood who will look out not only for their own children, and if they're providing well for their own, that's marvelous, but who will look beyond their own children to all those other children that are out there just simply hurting. A lot of them are not going to make it. They're not going to even be adults ever. They're going to die. They're going to be on drugs. They're going to be left. They're going to be in terrible trouble. You don't need to hardly read to see it happening all around us. I've been deeply involved in child issues. I've tended more than 1,000 in my home. I've worked in PTA for years and done all those things, and I just see too much pain. I want you to address, all of you, some of the lower part of society, all the hurt and all the protection that the church can offer and bring, whether it's men and women. We've got to stretch. We have really got to stretch. We've got to extend beyond our own pleasant lives, some of us, and help all the pain.
Somebody answered me.
I have two reactions to her statement. The first reaction is I can feel the pain and I have seen the pain. I work as a family therapist and have for 10 years and have worked for the better part of that years with families who have no money and mostly with single mothers who have no money and with children and trying to find jobs or trying to find ways to live on welfare until they can get a job or go to school and get a job. And I share equal concern about no money and no time and no resources and sometimes no personal resources to take care of children. And I know that that's not just a church issue, it's a whole societal issue. The United States is one of the few Western civilized countries which does not have a national family policy, which does not address, I mean, most other countries address issues of child care and address issues of money for specialized programs, and the United States has chosen not to address a family issue, and that always means children's issues. Family roles always mean women's issues, and women's issues always mean children's issues. I've noticed how that always goes back and forth. And so I really agree with that, in that we have a lot of pain, and that it is true throughout most of our society and through whatever kind of culture you will find large numbers of children who are not being taken care of or taken care of adequately. My other feeling about the statement is kind of was epitomized by a trip to the University of Utah bookstore a couple of months ago, and it was a book about how to interpret the media reports on national statistics and media statistics and so on. And the name of the book was "The Good News Is, the Bad News Is Wrong." And what I mean by that is that I believe, after reviewing family statistics and child care statistics and research about families over the last 20 years, that we, in fact, are doing as well or better as a nation with understanding children, taking care of children, giving them good care as we ever have in the history of the world. That the history of childhood in the world is a painful, torturous story. And it's only in the last 100 years we have overall recognized children as beings with rights that are on the par with adults and that they need to be nurtured and will become adults. And that, in fact, we have programs, technology, understanding, techniques, and resources for children that are more available to every class of society than ever has been in the history of the world, and we have it here now in the United States. And that we as a society, I think, are very concerned, even though there is no national policy, at reaching out to children and to give them food and to give them care. And I think we should recognize that across the board, that there is always a two-sided story. There is one of pain, and there is one of increasing growth. Thank you.
I have a reaction or two, too, that perhaps are worth stating. One of them is that when you said the upper third is doing fine, what about the lower two-thirds? I don't know what you mean by the upper third. It seems to me if we're talking about the socioeconomic upper third, there are problems there as severe as anywhere else up and down the line. If we're talking about a lucky third where this emerging pattern of two career families and so forth seems to be working well, then perhaps you're right. But I don't see any relationship between socioeconomic status and the success or lack of success of children in negotiating their way through the world. My other reaction is one of agreement with you, which is that as a scoutmaster, I've over about the last 3 or 4 years, I've become much more keenly aware of the truth of what you're saying, that is, how many children in a typical middle-class neighborhood are suffering from real deprivation of one kind or another. And it comes back to Tim's statistic that only one family out of five, even right here in Happy Valley, is a traditional, stable family with two parents and several children all getting along fine, which has led me to a conclusion I arrived at even before this experience as a scoutmaster, and that is that we are all, in a very tangible way, involved in raising each other's children. That raising our children has not been an endeavor in which just Linda and I have been involved, but we owe a great debt to a lot of people in our family and a lot of people in our neighborhood. And I think each of us has to return that debt by being parents in some very tangible ways to other children of various ages all around us, up and down our streets.
Thank you.
I don't think we have any good evidence that women working create any of the problems you've talked about. We can find individual cases where it does, but we can find individual cases that are just the opposite. So that on the average, the one thing about women working that may create the problems you're discussing is women who are forced to work and don't have the skills to get a decent job. And that may be where the children suffer the most. So, again, as I said before, it's child care that is the real issue here, not women's economic role. We don't have any strong evidence that women working increases the chances for divorce once you take into account other characteristics of women who work. We don't have any strong evidence that women working inhibits children's development or religious activity or other things. It's something other than whether the woman has a career or an economic role that makes a difference here.
There are a lot of things I'd like to say. I'll say two of them that I feel the most strongly about for a moment. One brief statement I'd like to make is that I think that it's a mistake to ignore the whole issue of whether or not women enjoy what they're doing in terms of the issue of flexibility. Women, I've worked full-time all the time. I was raising my four children. I'm a single parent. And I love my work. And I think part of why it has felt successful to me and to them, and I mean, maybe other people may think we're doing a horrible job, but we feel very good, is that I love my work. And I think that that has been able to sustain me, and I think people should consider that in their calculations when they're thinking about job choices. Now, the other thing I want to say, I'm not sure if it's in disagreement or in agreement with some of the things that have been said about economics and all that, but one of the things that I think is very critical to remember is that at the beginning of the women's movement, as you said, there was this big push to work on social policy, and then, as you say, that some of that didn't work, and so we went into this mode of speak for yourself, the personal is powerful, each person speak for his or herself, and I think it's very healthy to emphasize the fact that you can't stereotype and that you have to they have to acknowledge that there are incredible and infinite varieties of differences of experience. But in doing that, I think we really endanger the progress towards societal and worldwide solutions, and that is that we allow for each person to come up with his or her own solution, and it allows us to ignore however you want to cut the pie into the two-thirds or the one-third or whatever. And the fact that we have yuppie parents all over the world who are doing wonderfully because they can afford, extravagantly expensive child care, And they can talk about, well, from a personal experience, I can tell you that working is wonderful and two career families can do it and you can do it all and all that. That does not address the problems. And I sort of take issue with the fact that we're doing so well in America and around the world. I mean, all over the world there are increasing numbers of children suffering terribly from deprivation. And I think that the more that we say, those of us who have a strong voice and who have the luxury of being able to go and speak and at conferences and sort of can free ourselves from the drudgery of daily life, as long as we can say, well, gee, it feels good to me and that my experience is it succeeding, we often forget the masses of people who are not succeeding. And I think we really do have to continue to remind ourselves that it is a societal problem. It's a worldwide societal problem, not even just an American problem. And there isn't many solutions. There's one big solution. There may be many individual solutions within that, but there has to be one big solution, and it has to say kids need to be taken care of. I feel strong.
Just a brief word in support of Judy's point. I just got back from several days in Canada, in British Columbia, and going to various attractions there and driving through the cities and various places, I was very much impressed with the fact that this is a country where social concerns, where concerns for the society as a whole, such as the idea that it's very much in the interest of the society as a whole for children to be brought up in a secure, confident, nurturing environment. Ways in which it was manifested, many of their public works and their gardens and so many areas that are pretty crummy looking in America, they have been willing to make a bigger social effort, spend less individually,
spend more as a society to handle some of these social concerns. And it seems to me that many of these things fall in this category, that corporations, I think they're free enterprise is great, but I really am supportive of the idea that we need more public pushing of corporations to look out for the long-range social interest of generations coming along in terms of how we take care of our children.
All of you have, at one time or another, I think, taken issue, either subtly or more directly, with the church's portrayal of the ideal family, which I think one of you said appears visually from time to time in the ensign. I have a series of questions that are interrelated. First, where does this model come from? Second, why does it have such a hold upon the church institution and its leadership? And third, what model would you have proposed had you had the opportunity to present an encyclical to the church?
I'll let the rest of them answer the hard questions, and I'll start with the model. My husband suggests, and it makes considerable sense to me, that at least a part of the model comes from the Victorian ideal of womanhood and motherhood. What Tim suggested, when women were sort of divorced from women, in order to work, had to go outside the home, and when in industrial countries there was enough wealth accumulated that you could suddenly put a woman on a pedestal and create this this fantasy ideal of womanhood and the family circle as something to be cherished and protected and totally alienated from the rest of the world, that this appeared, particularly to late 19th century Latter-day Saint leaders, to be very attractive for a number of reasons, one of them being that the LDS people, the Mormon people, had been considered such rebels and such retrobates in so many ways, of course, because of plural marriage, and the moral outrage that was, because of their very un-American, uncapitalistic economic practices and such, that to be able to embrace a family ideal that by that time was beginning to ebb in the rest of the country was something that was very reassuring. That's at least a stab at one reason why the model seems to be such an appealing one.
I think it's reinforced by the characteristics required of people to be leaders in the church. I also think if we went back in time and saw a typical family in Israel or in Nephite times, it would not be that type of family in many ways. On a personal level, I don't see anything wrong with setting an ideal as a goal that we strive for and want to achieve, somewhat like the scripture, "Be ye therefore perfect." But there's a difference between having an ideal and striving toward that and expecting everybody to be exactly that way at any given point in time. My understanding is that's not what religion's about. So I'm not trying to attack what I see in my own personal life as a very important ideal and goal. I'm trying to say, what can we do as a religion to help people? And assuming that's the way everybody should be isn't the way we can help people the most.
We'll just pass this along here. Why the model causes me to reflect on John Kenneth Galbraith's comment not too long ago, as a matter of fact, that it is extremely rare that any privileged group or any privileged individual will voluntarily surrender that privilege. And I think it's very clear that men at least perceive that we have had the best shake. And it's true that we're learning and we're being liberated by new opportunities that come with new opportunities for women as well. But by and large, it seems to me, if you look, for example, at the institution of the Mormon Church, which not simply by custom, as may be the case at General Motors, accords practically all leadership positions to men, but by stark policy makes it impossible for women to occupy high leadership positions, then it seems to me it's pretty easy to see that there is a stake that the institution has in reinforcing the traditional values. As far as a model, if encyclicals were being sent forth, again, I reflect what the other two panelists have said. I don't think there is a model, and I think our problem is that we try to force a model where, in fact, there needs to be a great deal more ability to recognize different approaches to trying to solve a problem, which is part of the upheaval. Catherine.
How can I follow those through? I don't see the model as necessarily a negative thing. I see it negative only in that it's presented as the only model. And if we could show variations from that, I mean, I think it would add dimensions to that model, which is a very positive one.
Did you all get your turn? I think that it isn't good to have an only model, but I think it's good to strive for the best that we can. And certainly a church's role is to lead us, to strive for the best that we can, but we get awfully isolated. We get awfully isolated as a church, as United States citizens, and we forget that two-thirds of the rest of the world is starving, mostly children. And I can see one more ideal to add to all these ideals, and that would be to teach our children as we live with them to be concerned with those other nations that are starving to death. Children to children can become Christian, can live the gospel better, if you will. I like President Benson affirming that children should not be neglected, but we're not the only ones. And I think we need to work to that ideal as global Christians, because the world is very small and will either all rise or fall together, as you all know. And I don't believe that we can say that money alone will do it. However, money does help. You have to have money to run for office. If I had some, I'd run. You have to have a lot of money to change government, and a lot of money and a lot of pressure to change big business, which really runs the government, to care about children. And I think that is our job as voting citizens. What do you think?
Jack.
Agree.
I don't see the model presented in President Benson's address as an ideal. I see it as one of many models. I think as an ideal, as something we should strive for, as something we should feel guilty about and condemn ourselves for being selfish or unrighteous if we have not reached. I see that as doing more harm than good.
My question is a follow-up on just something you just said, and that is, it's not the first time, and it won't be the last, that a president of the church has made a statement that we maybe not have all agreed with. My question is, in light of what you said earlier about what women, working women, and their place in the home, and being that President Benson has been so adamant about what he said, how do you rationalize your feeling one way or the other based on whether that was actually a prophetic statement or just a darn good idea on his part?
Oh, thank you for that question. As I think we are all well aware within the church, there are several channels of revelation and instruction to which we try to attune ourselves. And one is a priesthood authority channel. It's one of extreme significance. One is a far more personal channel, but one, if we're sort of doing our spiritual homework properly, which I certainly don't claim to always be doing, in which we can feel we have the right to personal revelations from the Spirit. And this certainly isn't a question that just hit me 3 months ago, or whenever this came. Believe it or not, this issue has been around And indeed, that's one thing that bothered me about this assignment, is that whenever I came up with a conclusion, I thought, well, isn't that new and exciting? You know, I thought that out 25 years ago. This one, well, it was 15 years ago. In this kind of a case, since I do treasure the gospel and don't want to just shed it as excess baggage, I must listen to the inner voice and take the pronouncement of the prophet and find what I can in it that resonates for me and that I think is right and appropriate and what is going to make me a better, more Christian person. And you certainly could label that process rationalization, but that's where I'm at.
I guess I have two rules when I interpret prophetic statements. One is that the answer given depends on the question asked, and it helps to know the question asked to fully interpret the answer. And second, I observe what I call a halo effect, which is a misinterpretation of a sociological term, but often at the core, we may find a very valid idea, but we tend to generalize on that and bring in other ideas that seem to us closely related and include that as part of the concept. As I read again Bentz's statement, which I haven't handed out to my families yet, I found it at the heart of that as a reaffirmation of the importance of family. And when I read the 10 points at the end, I felt very strongly that those were things I should be doing a better job of. And I have no hesitation to endorse those things. The question is, how much of what is there is what I call halo effect and a limited answer based on a partial question or an incomplete question?
One of the observations I've had, and I suppose this all depends on who we talked with shortly after the February 22nd speech or address by President Benson and so forth, but it seems to me in the years that I've been a member of the church, it has been increasingly evident that members are able to make distinctions between what they agree with and don't agree with. And although there was a lot of expressed anger shortly after the February address, it seems to be a more common response has been women and men alike saying, there are some things there I agree with, there are some things I don't agree with. And they feel comfortable in coming to that conclusion. In short, as Tim has just done, finding in those 10 points some very good advice for all of us, and perhaps finding in some instructions about what we ought to see as the proper role for women or men in the family structure as being something that we're going to have to interpret for ourselves. So I think people are more likely to weigh and to agree and disagree and to sort through these kinds of statements now than it seems to me has been the case in the past, and therefore less likely to say, that's just terrible, I'm going to leave the church, or I don't see anything there of value. Much more inclined to see the good and the bad and to be able to make personal decisions about how those kinds of advice may pertain to us personally.
Let me just add and see if you agree with this. We found in the 1960s that the Catholics had started to use birth control at very high rates. And the Pope came out and said that was wrong. Catholics did not stop being Catholics, nor did they stop using birth control. They continued, especially the most devout Catholics, to be very devout, very committed to their religion, at the same time ignoring one of the things the Pope said. I think we may see the same thing happen more and more among Mormons, that we'll find less homogeneity and more selected dissent among people who are very committed to their religion.
I'd like to address the panel on
zeroing in on the topic here of the changing roles in family in Mormonism. And according to what you have just said, and I agree with you, that Latter-day Saints are changing more like the world in selecting not to have as many children. And I'd like to go back to what is purported that Joseph Smith stated, that in the latter days, none but the Latter-day Saint women would be willing to bear children. I think that we are seeing that come to pass, and I say a very few of the Latter-day Saint women themselves may be willing to bear children as the latter days increase in dangers and pressures and crises and so forth. I think that's one of the changes that we ought to address here. The fact that statistically we are almost with the rest of the nation in the number of children. Also, one other point, Dr. Lindsay and others have said that statistically, if the numbers continue as they have in these past few years, by the year 2000, which I am reminded is only 13 years away, that there would be no father, mother, traditional parents in the homes of America. And he wasn't saying except for the Latter-day Saints. I'm hoping that somehow those statistics are going to be wrong. I mean, that projection is going to be wrong. And those of us in Zion will still have families, that is, two-parent families, to a much greater rate than the rest of the nation. But I see those two particular problems that I haven't heard addressed, and I think there are great changes in Mormonism, families in Mormonism today. The rate of children, divorces, etc., which are eliminating the traditional parents in the home.
Well, I would like to address the first question that you asked, I think, most of all. I think that sometimes, as Mormons, we think that we have a corner on the market when it comes to family issues and family concerns. And having heard, as I said, from women across the country, we share that interest in children with a lot of other people, Catholics, Jewish, atheists, are still having children and are finding that an important part of their life. And that the numbers may be less, they may be having fewer children, but I don't necessarily agree with the projection that that means that they will stop having children. I would have, and I've never heard that prediction before.
Your comment also raises in my mind a distinction that we haven't made very well tonight, and that is the one between traditional family values on the one hand and traditional families on the other. It seems to me if we're talking about traditional family values, by which we mean a nurturing, loving environment, not only for the children but for everyone involved, learning a high degree of consideration for other people, learning how you make decisions that involve other people and affect other people as well as yourselves. It seems to me we shouldn't be talking about the attrition of family values at all, but we're talking about different family structures, possibly providing a context in which those kinds of traditional values can still be taught and nurtured. And indeed, I think those values are central to the survival of society.
I live in an area where we have the most children that they can possibly have, out in Sandy. And I love it. The children are just darling. I love them, every one of them in our neighborhood. However, I have young mothers talking to me all the time, and they say that a lot of them are going to work in our neighborhood. And I think a lot of it is because children are demanding so much. Each child has to have a bike. In our day, we had two bikes and we took turns. Each child has to have their Hot Wheels. They have to have all the same fancy clothes that other children have. And there's so much pressure on the mothers, and I hear them talking about it all the time, and they say they're selfish. What are we doing wrong? And yet a lot of these people are going to work. Is it to give these kids things along with the other self-satisfaction? I don't blame them for going to work. If they want to work, I'm all for it. If they can do it and still maintain a family that's happy, if they are not just worrying themselves to death how they're going to give kids things. Would you address that just a little bit?
I think that more than wanting to give kids things, a lot of, and for the woman who doesn't need to, you know, from a severe economic point of view, go to work, I think a lot of women are going to work because there's incredible, incredible pressure to do that. And I think that women who make the choice to stay at home, even for a period of their life or forever if they choose, feel that pressure. And it's a societal pressure. And we are in a period of time where we place a lot of value on work outside the home. And I can say that, you know, from a personal perspective and from having heard from a lot of women about that issue. There's tremendous societal pressure to be in the workforce.
In my neighborhood, it's not bicycles, it's Boy Scout shirts. Y'all got to have the official Boy Scout shirt. So maybe they're working to provide something that the church program insists the children have to be comparable with all the other children. I know this because the last time my boy was the only one without a Boy Scout shirt.
I have a tendency to say what I think, and I did this in Relief Society after President Benson's speech, and since that time I have been somewhat of a pariah. I'm going to say it here tonight, too. We're not supposed to apparently address the emotions that these things bring forward in us. I have six young women in my family, daughter-in-laws and daughters. Every one of them reacted the same way I did, but none of them dared say so. I was resentful, and I'm still resentful. I get tired of men, no matter how beloved, no matter how high their calling, always setting up models, setting up patterns that I'm supposed to fit into, that my daughters and daughter-in-laws and my granddaughters are going to possibly try to fit into. We're all different. There isn't any, I've got six of them now, more than that coming up. None of us are alike. We're all so different, you wouldn't believe how different we are. But we're all supposed to be exactly alike. We're supposed to stay home and raise children and do this and do this and do that. Go to Relief Society every Sunday and attend all of our meetings and be active in the church and raise children and don't go to work. And most of the time, every one of those six girls work, and they work because they have to. And I resent them being put in a position of a guilt trip being laid on them for providing necessities for their children.
I'm just thinking how wonderful it would be if one of the changing perceptions of family in Mormonism, it could be that we might begin to function in an eternal two-parent family rather than in the single-parent eternal family, which at least is our perception, if not the reality. And wouldn't it be wonderful? Wouldn't it be wonderful if the prophet should ever invite the mother in heaven to come home?
It's interesting to see Carolyn. All half the way home from Canada, we were. I have my sister and her family who came with me recently performed in
in her musical play, The Order is Love, and that's a favorite of our family, so we were singing songs from that all the way home. And it just reminds me that I think there have been some very well-made points tonight about needs of many children within the church, of many children within our neighborhoods, and many who touch our lives. And I think a model that accepts everybody's particular strengths and gifts in helping and realizes that some will help in staying at home and others will help in the PTA and others will help in the community council and others will help through their other kinds of talents, that that in approaching it in this kind of pragmatic way, which I think is really envisioned in terms of the church community working together as a big family, that we're going to have a bigger chance of meeting some of the needs of children that haven't been met.
I'd just like to say a word about a thesis that was recently completed at BYU on Mother in Heaven and groups of women who meet at retreats. They're a very interesting group of women, highly educated, very committed to the church on the average. The thing that correlates most with their belief in Mother in Heaven in this group is traditional belief in other Mormon theology. Feminism has a little bit of a relationship, but by and large it appears that Mother in Heaven is a theology for more traditional types of women. And it is a very interesting theology, but in its present form it does not appear by and large to be a liberating theology or a theology that would provide new roles for Mormon women. Maybe if it were developed more and we understood more, it would, but in its present form it doesn't.
I think I'm responding a little bit to Jack's comment about men's desire to preserve their preserve, as it were. If I were more of an organizational behaviorist, I might understand the church's protectionist position. But it seems to me that tomorrow the church could begin to reverse the conditions that women live under, particularly single women, the conditions that the children of single mothers have to live under. Bishops could offer fast offerings for educational purposes, for child care while women work to improve their economic status. When the church is willing to improve the economic condition of women, they will show me that they truly value women.
Mine also is a statement rather than a question, and I'd like to address the issue that was brought up quite a while ago concerning those children who are in pain, the 2/3, I think was the statistic that was given. I work with those children. I do therapy with incestuous families, and so my job is to listen to the children, the mothers, the fathers, the families, the couples. And I feel their pain, and I think it's a crucial issue that we need to address. One thing that I found particularly in this situation, though, and I think we need to consider this, how many times I have heard, and I think any therapist has heard, but I was told, and then they go on with, this is the mother, I was told that if I would just do what I was supposed to do and get married, have these children, everything was going to work out all right. The reality of it is, you can't count on another person. Those women can't count on those men. And when the charges of incest come up, it is the woman again who suffers. The man is put in prison or in Fremont, taken out of the house, has the luxury of not dealing with the problem, and the woman is home dealing with the problem that she was told that if she followed this model, she would never have to deal with these problems. My statement is this, that because the model fits so rarely, and because we present that model so universally, we create problems. We don't even begin to look at reality. When the idealism comes in conflict with the reality, that is when the children hurt. If we as a people can begin to look at the reality of what this world is,
throw out the model, look at the diversity, teach our young women and our primary children to develop their abilities. I think maybe 50 years down the road, we might have children not hurting so desperately.
I wanted to bring up something which has only been touched on tangentially here. We're talking about changing family roles, and it's all been about the woman. Almost. If you won't take me seriously, I will say as a joking anthropologist that you women ought to understand that we men get up in the morning and go, and we're gone all day, and we come home tired, and we really don't do any parenting. And if you women leave, then the kids don't get any parenting. So we want you in the home. I think actually, along with the discussion of the women's changing roles and flexibility, should go an equal discussion of the men's responsibility for flexibility in their workplace to allow them more time and more opportunity to do their share of the parenting.
I would just support that from a personal perspective, having spent the last year with my return to work after 9 years of being at home and my husband staying at home while he's pursuing another degree. And it's been a fascinating and interesting year.
I support that concern and have felt strongly about having an equal discussion of men's roles and changing men's roles and encouraging men to think about those roles. And so if you would give us your name at the end of the session, we'll be glad to talk about a panel next year about changing men's roles in Mormonism.
On that subject, I have to say I started changing men's roles with my little boys when they were little, and they are the new kind of father, much more than the old kind. And I really have a strong feeling for men in their strengths. But what I've seen lately, and this is really personal, I don't know the way to describe it right now, but the last 6 months I've been in a program for actually helping mostly women who are needing to start a career. And they have had various experts come in and talk to us about assertiveness training, which is everybody's heard of assertiveness training. And it has been carried to an extreme that I could not really believe. It is, women, look out for yourself. If the children are in the way, push them off to the side. You matter. Look out for yourself. And I've seen women turned against women. Catherine, you must sit defending women in the home, that women in the home are valued almost not at all in this country. There is no value. I can say when I look for a job that I've done thus and thus and thus for 30 years in the home, there's no value in it. There is truly no value. They say that's very commendable, but we are not going to give you a job on that basis. And then I have seen it go to the extreme where in Network Magazine last month, there was a woman who hires. Now, she was staying undercover as far as her name because she said she's LDS. She's decided not to have children. Because children really interfere. They really do. And so not only does she feel that children are really an interference and she's not going to admit to her family that she's chosen not to have them, but in her hiring, she will not hire children, women with children, because, as she said, their head is not on their job. So she will always give preference in the business world to women who have no children. And I am seeing women pitted against women and men being released of all responsibility. And I see a really dangerous selfishness growing. I guess maybe we blame men for being selfish. I haven't really seen men as being as selfish as people say they have been. I've seen them out there earning a living, which is a tremendous responsibility. And I don't see that as selfish. But when I see this pitting of adults against adults, women in the home against women at work, and believe me, there's power in money. That power that men have had in money, women, if they start feeling it, they want it.
And there are women who want it to the extent that they will step on any other woman who is in their way. They have, like, sold out. The values of the home, the mother, the children are nothing. Their value is, if you can become an important money-making woman, you've got it all. And that's dangerous, and it frightens me. And I see it as a great danger to children. And I would really like, because you've listed yourself as a defender of women in the home, Catherine, I would like you to address it first.
Well, I think there that you raised a couple of issues, and I hope that I responded to some of those, you know, as I spoke. One of those is women being pitted against other women, and I think that that's happened to a great degree. I think it's probably over-exaggerated, that there are some individuals who have difficulty with each other, but for the most part, I think it's been over-exaggerated. I think that will tend to disappear as we as women, as some of those stereotypes disappear, and as we as women realize that we have a lot more in common than we do, you know, at variance, and that for those of us who are mothers with children, I still believe that most of us, whether we're working or whether we're at home, share that belief that our children are a priority. There are exceptions to that, but I think the majority of women who have children feel that their children are a priority, and they work very hard at keeping it that way. The other issues that you spoke to, maybe you can say that again for me. You wanted me to address women being pitted against women, and then the lack of value being placed on women at home. I guess I haven't found that to be true in terms of the way that most women and most mothers perceive their children. I do agree with your statement that as these roles have changed, there is less and less value placed on that role of motherhood and the mother at home.
One of the things that I haven't heard addressed at all is the woman who is forced into the labor situation because of illness, you know, maybe illness of her husband or illness of children that brings a large debt to the family, which has nothing to do with divorce and not having two parents in the home. But, you know, husbands can die and leave a large family, and it forces women into it. And I do think that, as the lady stated, that sometimes it forces these women into feeling a real guilt trip when they feel that they should be at home with their children and there is absolutely no way that they can be. And I would just like to know how you feel about that situation.
I think if we stop and think about it, there are many legitimate reasons for people to work besides just making a living. In fact, if I remember right, if you just do things for money, that's Satan's plan to get people. So you're right about women having to work because they have to support a family, whether the husband left them or died or is ill or whatever else. But we can think of many other legitimate reasons for people to work when they feel like they make a real contribution in the labor force that they couldn't make elsewhere. And we should stress the importance of those reasons for men and women as well as just for bringing in the bacon. So it shouldn't just be an economic issue. It should be a fulfillment and contribution issue. And you shouldn't feel guilty for wanting to make that kind of contribution.
I'm stuck kind of back with the hurting children because I have spent 26 years in the schools, 11 of them being a counselor, and I've seen the hurting children. And I've thought a lot about what can we do
to solve this problem. And I think that lots of times, yes, we're talking about two levels of society or more. A lot of what we've been talking about are people who do a good job with their children. The really and truly hurting children I have seen are the children who probably could not have been born to the people they were born to at the time they were born. Many times, a hurting child was born to a child. And there was no knowledge about how to raise children. And there was certainly no commitment to the huge amount of responsibility that having children entails. As a person in the schools, I sometimes wonder about the commitment of a lot of us to the responsibility that children entail. The cost of educating them, for example. I guess if I would like to suggest anything, and I'm open to any other ideas about this, it would be that we spend more time teaching our young people the sacred responsibility of having children. I know we do it, but somehow we combine that with a huge, huge pressure to be married as soon as possible, to have children as soon as possible, and to have as many as possible. And sometimes that really does create hurting children. I see teenagers choosing people to be with because they've got to have somebody to be with, and they don't pay very much attention to whether that person offers them a future with a healthy home and a healthy relationship. So I would like to see maybe a shift away from intense pressure to have children and more toward what a wonderful blessing it is and also what a great responsibility it is.
We'd like to thank you for coming this evening and for sharing your feelings and your emotions and your thoughts and asking us to share ours. We hope that you enjoy the rest of the symposium, and I'd like in closing to remind you, for those of you who didn't come in earlier, that there still are some tickets to the dialogue banquet tomorrow evening. Thank you for coming, and I hope these questions keep reverberating in your minds and solutions keep coming up in your dreams, and that you keep talking about them and that you keep sharing them with everyone around you, and I hope solutions come. Thank you.